Namaste. There are lots of definitions for meditation. One of them I like is noticing what's happening while it's happening and simultaneously observing your relationship to what's happening. But I think the definition that I like the best, I think is most apt, perhaps at this time in the retreat, is that meditation is one insult after another. I got permission from a yogi in interview this morning who confessed that he woke up in sort of a mental reverie in his meditation, noticing that his mind was doing an in-depth analysis of the characters on Gilligan's Island. Perhaps you can relate. As we've been diving in deep, practicing presence, working with the waves, the fluctuations of the internal experience, there is perhaps, hopefully, a little bit of settling, more of a noticing faculty happening. And I wanted to talk tonight a little bit about the fruit of the practice. What is it that begins to arise? What is the byproduct of all this effort that you're putting in? And this is about the awakening of wisdom and the awakening of compassion. I'd like to talk a little more about the compassion side, about what compassion is, the barriers to compassion, and to explore some of the practices of how you can more actively and consciously cultivate compassion in your practice this week. The word vipassana means to see clearly. And what we're practicing is seeing clearly meditation. We're moving from our story to what's actually happening. And from everything I can tell from meeting with people these last days is that we're beginning to wake up. And sometimes waking up is kind of a rude awakening. Have you ever been in an argument and then suddenly realized that you're wrong? It's never. We need to talk. That's a revealing and humbling moment. Like, how quickly can you shift to what's true? And that's what this practice gives us, the opportunity again and again and again. It is so deeply humbling. As the saying goes, when you argue with reality, you're going to lose every time. One thing you may notice in your practice is that when it really gets down to it, we're pretty self-centered. Everything is about me and mine. And it's when me and mine either drops away or dissolves a little bit is when things get really interesting. It's when the mystery becomes a little more present. And particularly when you're under stress, you calcify. The I and mine gets very, very tight. The self-centeredness gets very, very tight. As I was reflecting this, I was just reminded of a time when I had kind of one of those wake-up experiences where I shifted from self-centeredness to more of an awareness of others. This was quite a few years ago. I was 13. And my sister had just gotten married, and they were going on their honeymoon. And my parents and his parents and my aunt and uncle, my younger brother, and I decided to go along with them. I come from a family of campers, and this is not an unusual experience. We went to the National Boundary Waters canoe area, if you've ever been there. It's pure wilderness. 11 days of canoeing. We would, cross lakes and portage to another lake, and It was quite a powerful experience. The first couple of days were really quite wonderful. It was beautiful weather. On day four, it rained. On day five, it rained. And on day six, it rained. We had canvas tents. I don't know if you remember those old canvas tents. If you touched the wall, everything would start leaking. Our tents were wet. Our sleeping bags were wet. We were cooking with wood, so all the wood was soaked. And I remember I was, 13, so I was 6'3" and weighed about 80 pounds. And and you know how it is when it's cold and you're wearing wet jeans and you don't want to move because another piece of wet jean material will come in contact with your skin? I was about as miserable as I've ever been. And I remember I said to my dad, as we were trying to get a fire started, I said, if I had an anvil, I would tie it around my neck and I would throw it in that lake. I saw a look from my father I had never seen before, the way he looked at me. He never talked about his experiences in World War II, but I knew that his shoulder would get dislocated easily from an injury in the war, and that whenever he would go through a metal detector in an airport, the metal detector would go off because of the shrapnel in his body. And he gave me a look with his steely eyes, and he said, hey, no one's shooting at us. It snapped me out of my self-centeredness. And then I remember looking around and seeing everyone else who was also soaked, making camp and doing what they needed to do. It was just one of those very poignant shock of shifting from a deep self-centeredness to realizing other people feel this too. And it's that other people feel this too that becomes the bridge to awakening compassion, and what I'd like to talk about a little bit tonight. The basis of the whole transformational process is mindfulness, the sense of non-judging awareness. Tulku Urgen, who is a great Dzogchen master, said, there is one thing we always need, and that is the watchman, named mindfulness, the guard who is always on the lookout for when we get carried away by mindlessness. This moment-to-moment-to-moment awareness of sensations, of thought forms, of moods, emotions, and states, our environment, is the key. And that's what we're cultivating through concentration, through relaxation, through noticing, through allowing, through cultivating kindness. And Pat shared that four-word summary of the Satipatthana Sutta. Keep calmly knowing change. And that implies keep calmly knowing change and how you're relating to that change. That noticing how you're relating to change is critical. One advantage of social silence is that it heightens the awareness of the conversations that you're having internally. And maybe you've noticed just how truly shameless your mind is. There's no little rat hole your mind won't go down. You probably have noticed that by now. And maybe you've noticed your reactivity. There's a sensitizing to that stream of Vedana, to that felt sense of unpleasant, pleasant, and neutral. In this slowing down, in this paying attention, there can be a much more heightened and refined sense of this play of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, and the unconscious reactivity toward it. And huge, huge insights and possibilities are possible when you can pay attention at that level. So from the standpoint of the ego, our tightly held identification with the body, the mind, the thoughts, the emotions, our beliefs, we live in a very small and a very tight and a very narrow little world. And remembering the three characteristics of reality, as Pat was talking about last night, they help us to widen our field of awareness. To remember anicca, that everything is changing. And to remember the element of dukkha, that your relationship to what is changing directly impacts the degree that you will feel stress and suffering. And the reflection on anatta, that this self that you traditionally take yourself for is also subject to change. And selflessness, that falling away of I and mine is perhaps who you truly are, the sense of the absolute self. So remembering these, that everything is changing, your relationship to what is changing determines the degree of stress and suffering, and that this sense of self, of who you take yourself to be, is also impermeable and subject to change on many levels. It changes the frame, it opens things up. And there are other trainings that can help you in this as well. And one of the trainings is the conscious cultivation of compassion. Ananda, who was the Buddha's personal assistant, asked him once, he said, "Would it be true to say that the cultivation of loving kindness and compassion is a part of our practice?" And the Buddha said, "No. It would be true to say that the cultivation of loving kindness and compassion is all of our practice." It can be challenging to remember that when we're struggling staying with the breath, or are struggling to hold a degree of equanimity, that compassion actually is all of the practice. The Buddha said that compassion is that which makes the heart respond to the pain of others. It is called compassion because it shelters and embraces the distressed. Of course, that includes your own distress, as well as the distress of others. So compassion has something to do with how we interact with ourselves, but it also has to do with how we interact with each other. So wisdom is one of the fruits of practice, the recognition of what is true, your capacity to kind of drill through your preferences, your embellishments, your stories, to really contact what is true. And the second fruit is this arising of compassion, the capacity to respond to the pain of others and to our own pain is what shifts us from self to selflessness. There was a story a number of years ago, you may recall this one. This is a selection, a reading about this. And Victoria Ruvolo can tell you about random pain. On a November evening in 2004, this 44-year-old New Yorker was driving to her home on Long Island. She just attended her niece's recital and was ready for the couch, a warm fire, and relaxation. She doesn't remember seeing the silver Nissan approaching from the east. She remembers nothing of the 18-year-old boy leaning out the window holding, of all things, a frozen turkey. He threw it at her windshield. The 20-pound bird crashed through the glass, bent the steering wheel inward, and shattered her face like a dinner plate. The violent prank left her grappling for life in the ICU. She survived, but only after doctors wired her jaw, affixed one eye by synthetic film, and bolted titanium plates to her cranium. She can't look in the mirror without a reminder of her hurt. 9 months after her disastrous November night, she stood face to titanium-bolted face with her offender in court. Ryan Cushing was no longer the cocky, turkey-tossing kid in the Nissan. He was trembling, tearful, and apologetic. For New York City, he had become to symbolize a generation of kids out of control. People packed the room to see him get his comeuppance. The judge's sentence enraged them. Only 6 months behind bars, 5 years probation, some counseling, and some public service. The courtroom erupted. Everyone objected. Everyone, that is, except Victoria Ruvalo. The reduced sentence was her idea. The boy walked over and she embraced him. In full view of the judge and the crowd, she held him and stroked his hair. He sobbed and she spoke. "I forgive you. I want your life to be the best it can be." She allowed grace to shape her response. "God gave me a second chance at life and I passed it on," she said of her largesse. "If I hadn't let go of that anger, I'd be consumed by this need for revenge. Forgiving him helps me move on." Her mishap led to her mission, volunteering with the county probation department. "I'm trying to help others, but I know for the rest of my life, I'll be known as the turkey lady." "It could have been worse," she said. "He could have thrown a ham, and then I'd be Miss Piggy." Despite her own pain, she was able to contemplate the pain of her abuser. And she said to him, "I want your life to be the best it can be." Do you know that feeling of wanting the best for people? And you may have noticed that it's really easy for family, for children, for your best friends. It's not so easy to the people you feel indifferent toward. And for the people you have difficulty with, it's enormously challenging to wish the best for their life. So what is that capacity that opens up forgiveness in the face of such senseless violence and suffering? It has something to do with selflessness, that the easing of that tightly held sense of I and mine, and your capacity to imagine and feel what another person may be feeling. And this is the field of transformation. It's where new possibilities arise where they did not exist before. Somehow, Victoria Ruvalo was able to shift from her point of view to imagine and feel the life of another. So compassion, it's a skillful means. She found it through extreme adversity. But like any muscle, we can develop it through practice. It doesn't mean it's easy. Sogyal Rinpoche said, "The times when you are suffering can be those when you are open and where you are extremely vulnerable. And this can be where your greatest strength really lies. Say to yourself, I am not going to run away from the suffering. I want to use it in the best and richest way I can so that I can become more compassionate and more helpful to others. Suffering, after all, can teach us about compassion. If you suffer, you will know how it is when others suffer. And if you are in a position to help others, it is through your suffering that you will find the understanding and compassion to do so." So compassion is a good thing, we all agree. Accessing compassion can be tremendously challenging. So I'd like to share another story with you and then talk a little bit about some of the very interesting studies that have been done that have identified the barriers to compassion and how to work through those barriers to gain access to this state that is kind of described as an immeasurable state. When you're in that state of compassion, you cannot measure it. It's an infinitely large state. This is a story called The Good Conductor at Peterborough. One act of kindness that befell British writer Bernard Hare in 1982 changed him profoundly. Then a student living just north of London, he tells the story to inspire troubled young people to help deal with their disrupted lives. The police called at my student hovel early evening, but I didn't answer, as I thought they'd come to evict me. I hadn't paid the rent in months. But then I got to thinking, my mom hadn't been feeling too good, and what if something was up about her? We had no phone in the hovel, and mobiles hadn't been invented yet, so I had to nip down to the phone box. I rang home to Leeds to find my mother was in hospital and not expecting to survive the night. "Get home, son," Dad said. I got to the railway station to find I'd missed the last train. A train was going as far as Peterborough, but I would miss the connecting Leeds train by 20 minutes. To this day, I won't hear a bad word said about British Rail. I bought a ticket home and got on anyway. I was a struggling student and didn't have the money for a taxi for the whole way, but I had a screwdriver in my pocket and a bunch of skeleton keys. I was so desperate to get home that I planned to nick a car in Peterborough, hitchhike, steal some money, something, anything. I just knew from my dad's tone of voice that my mother was going to die that night, and I intended to get home if it killed me. "Tickets, please," I heard as I stared blankly out the window at the passing darkness. I fumbled for my ticket and gave it to the guard when he approached. He stamped it, but then he just stood there looking at me. I'd been crying and had red eyes and must have looked a fright. "You okay?" he asked. "Of course I'm okay," I said. "Why wouldn't I be? What's it got to do with you in any case?" "Oh, you look awful," he said. "Is there anything I can do?" "You could get lost and mind your own business," I said. "That'd be a big help." I was not in the mood for talking. He was only a little bloke, and he must have read the danger signals in my body language and tone of voice. But he sat down opposite me anyway and continued to engage me. "If there's a problem, I'm here to help," he said. "That's what I'm paid for." I was a big bloke in my prime, so I thought for a second about physically sending him on his way, but somehow it didn't seem appropriate. He wasn't really doing much wrong. I was going through all the stages of grief at once: denial, anger, guilt, withdrawal, everything but acceptance. I was a bubbling cauldron of emotion, and he had placed himself in my line of fire. The only thing I could think of to get rid of him was to tell him my story. "Look, my mom's in the hospital dying. She won't survive the night. I'm going to miss my connection to Leeds at Peterborough. I'm not sure how I'm going to get home. It's tonight or never. I won't get another chance. I'm a bit upset. I don't feel like talking. I'd be grateful if you leave me alone, okay?" "Okay," he said, finally getting up. "I'm sorry to hear that, son. I'll leave you alone then, and I hope you make it home in time." And he wandered off down the carriage, back the way he came. I continued to look out the window at the dark. 10 minutes later, he was back at my side of the table. "Oh no," I thought, "here we go again. This time, I'm really gonna drag him down the train." He touched my arm. "Listen, when we get to Peterborough, shoot straight over to Platform 1 as quick as you like. The Leeds train will be there." I looked at him dumbfounded. It wasn't really registering. "Come again?" I said stupidly. "What do you mean? Is it late or something?" "No, it isn't late," he said defensively, as if he really cared whether trains were late or not. "No, I've just radioed Peterborough. They're going to hold up the train for you. As soon as you get on, it goes. Everyone will be complaining about how late it is, but let's not worry about that on this occasion. You get home. That's the main thing. Good luck. God bless." Then he was off down the train again. "Tickets, please. Any more tickets now?" I suddenly realized what a top-class, fully-fledged jerk I was. And I chased him down the train. I wanted to give him all the money from my wallet, my driver's license, my keys, but I knew he'd be offended. I caught up and I grabbed his arms. I was suddenly speechless. "I wish to thank you in some way," I said. "I appreciate what you've done. Not a problem, he said. If you feel the need to thank me, the next time you see someone in trouble, you help them out. That'll pay me back amply. Tell them to pay you back the same way, and soon the world will be a better place. I was at my mother's side when she died in the early hours of the morning. Even now, I can't think of her without remembering the good conductor on that late night train to Peterborough. My meeting with a good conductor changed me from a selfish, potentially violent hedonist into a decent human being. But it took time. I've paid him back 1,000 times since then, I tell young people I work with, and I'll keep on doing so until the day I die. You don't owe me nothing, nothing at all. And if you think you do, I'll give you the same advice as the good conductor gave me. Pass it down the line. So that story makes me want to be a better person. And we all want to be more compassionate. And just as when it comes to mindfulness, when you have the intention to be present in the moment, and you pay attention to being present in the moment, you realize just how much you're not present. In that same way, when you begin to investigate compassion, you'll notice how you're not compassionate. That's the way the transformation process works. So it can be very interesting to reflect on what gets in the way between you and feeling compassion for yourself and feeling others. How do you close down? How do you tighten? What does that feel like inside when you shut down, when compassion is impossible? There is a center called the Stanford University Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education. Isn't it cool that there is a University Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education? That kind of blows my mind. I love the fact that there are very smart people studying compassion and altruism. Part of what their study has revealed is what gets in the way. I'll just read these, and you might kind of reflect if any of these sort of, you know, resonate for you in your relationship to cultivating compassion. This is what their research has shown up. This is done in 2011. Being compassionate towards people who have done bad things is letting them off the hook. We could put a true or false there. There are some people in life who don't deserve compassion. People will take advantage of me if they see me as too compassionate. I worry that if I am compassionate, vulnerable people will drain my emotional resources. Any of these resonating? They sure do for me. Here are fears of receiving compassion. I often wonder whether displays of warmth and kindness from others are genuine. When people are kind and compassionate towards me, I feel anxious or embarrassed. I'm fearful of becoming dependent on the care of others because they might not think I'm available or willing to give it. Here are what they have determined to be the core fears of self-compassion. I fear that if I become less self-critical, my standards will drop. I fear that if I am more self-compassionate, I will become a weak person. I fear that if I start to feel compassion or warmth toward myself, I will become overwhelmed with sadness. This dance with compassion, There are all these beliefs that we have to keep it at bay, and they're definitely worth investigating. Here's another finding, and I found this one to be quite fascinating. I certainly related to it, and that is that compassion goes down in relationship to the size of it. I had mentioned the other night that I lived in West Africa for a couple of years, and I did a lot of biking in West Africa. And I was in Niger, which has the second highest mortality rate on the planet. They have a 90-day growing season, and also the hottest mean temperature of any city in the planet where I lived. And everywhere I went, the most extreme poverty you can imagine. There were lines of people who had river blindness, who were led by small children who would just chant and beg. It was always basically kind of like a begging culture. Wherever I'd park my bike in town to go shopping or something like that, there would be a horde of people who would come, you know, asking for a petit cadeau, you know, for a little gift for guarding my bike. And wherever you would turn, there was someone in need. And there was one moment when I was bicycling through the city, and just kind of on a back street, taking a shortcut to the university where I taught, and I just stopped and I looked out, and there was the entire boulevard was children, ranging from little kids to, you know, to teenagers, just teeming with children. And it suddenly struck me that this land they were living on in no way could support all the life that was there. It just couldn't happen. And it's the realization that many of these children were not going to make it. There was no way they could make it. And I found myself shutting down. It was too much. And I only realized until very recently that there is something called compassion fatigue. And this is what this study came up with, one of their observations. As the size of suffering increases, the compassion people feel paradoxically tends to decrease. The enormity of the suffering, the shutting down of the compassion. So the question is, and this is their question, is this a failure to feel? Or is this a case of emotional regulation? You're just trying to keep your head above water in the face of such intense suffering. So it's very interesting. The image that will generate the most compassion will be the image of one child suffering. When there are two, the compassion drops. When there are four, the compassion drops more. When there are eight, the compassion drops even more. Which is why on so many of the appeals, there'll be one child, you know, one malnourished child, because they know that's the hook. That's what's going to capture you. Buddhism talks about suffering and the end of suffering. Our challenge is to meet the suffering where it is. And the challenge as well is to be gentle with ourselves in the face of that suffering, because it can be so overwhelming. We have to be vigilant to our own compassion fatigue, our own need for self-care. A wonderful writer said, "The greatest peril is not nuclear war and weapons, not climate change or the poisoning of seas and soil and air, not the impoverishment of more than half the world's population, nor the murderous genocidal wars flaring up. It is not the disappearance of cultures or the extinction of species. The greatest danger is the deadening of our hearts and minds. It arises not from indifference, but from fear. We fear we can't stand it. We fear we can't take it in." to stay present and available to compassion in the midst of suffering is enormously challenging. And it's very easy to slide into what is called the near enemy of compassion. And Thich Nhat Hanh says that the near enemy of compassion is pity. And this also separates us. Pity feels sorry for that poor person over there, as if that person was somehow different than us. So in the midst of all of this, in the midst of the world suffering, our personal suffering, how do we begin to gain access to compassion? Tara led the Tonglen meditation this afternoon, which is perhaps one of the most direct practices there is. And I want to talk about just kind of a very simple, almost pragmatic way of accessing compassion. And just from a personal standpoint, compassion comes from the capacity to recognize what another person is feeling. Early on in our marriage, we were in a conflict, and there was some subtle implication that part of the conflict was due to some of my behavior. It's hard to imagine that could be so. But I did what I tend to do, which is to withdraw and internalize. And there's that wonderful phrase that's very helpful to recognize in relationships, and that is, what you can't communicate controls you. So as I internalized it and that sort of festered inside, I built up a whole drama around what I was feeling and et cetera, et cetera. When we got to talking, I began to describe what I was feeling, and it came out quickly and rapidly and not so skillfully. And in the midst of a rather embarrassing eruption of my side of things, Tara said, "I totally get it. I would feel that way too." Suddenly the war was over. And I began to recognize the power of role reversal, the power of reaching into another person's experience and imagining what they're feeling. Sort of the joke now is like, whoever does the role reversal first wins. Wins for both of us. When we hold another as separate, it's impossible to bridge. When we can somehow expand our bandwidth and to imagine, to sense what another person may be feeling, the I and mine, that tightly held sense of I and mine, begins to dissolve. And amazing things can happen. So I thought it might be interesting to do a little reflection on this. You might, with your eyes closed, bring your awareness into your breath. And you might bring into mind someone with whom perhaps you've had some challenge, some difficulty, someone with whom you may feel some separation. You might take a few moments to kind of go through the files. You might find it helpful not to select the one person who's been your arch nemesis your entire life, but maybe to scale it back a little bit. Maybe someone's kind of a 5 or 6 on a scale of 1 to 10. And when you have someone in mind, you might find it helpful to sense if you could sort of specify a situation, an event, If you can't think of someone, you could make something up. But you might create an event, and you might imagine it either as a still, like a photograph, or you might envision it as kind of a video, a moving image. And as you reflect on this, you might find it helpful to invoke any visual qualities to this memory. Any colors, the time of day, quality of the light. You might even like to turn the colors up a little bit. It might actually sort of heighten the image a little bit. And in this reflection on a time of separation or conflict, you might invoke any auditory memories, any sounds, any words that were spoken, tone of voice. And you might now turn your attention to the kinesthetic, to what it feels like inside as you feel or imagine this sense of what it feels like to feel separate. Can you locate what that feels like inside? And you might, in your own way now, explore doing a role reversal. If you were able to place your awareness in the other's body, what do you imagine they're feeling? Could you imagine where they might feel that inside, in the felt sense in their body? Can you imagine and sense into the unmet need? What are they needing? What are they wanting? That's not happening. And can you imagine if that unmet need was met? What would that feel like for them? What would that be like for them? And you might just close this little inquiry just by offering the following words. May you be happy just as I wish to be happy. May you feel safe from inner and outer harm just as I wish to feel safe. May you know peace just as I wish to know peace. May you be free from suffering, just as I wish to be free. You might just sense in these closing moments what may have shifted inside through this inquiry. And as you're ready, you can deepen the breath and let the eyes open, or if you wish, you can remain with them closed. So the first and second noble truth say that stress and suffering happen. When you get one of these portable flesh units, stress and suffering is, it just comes with being human. And that there's a cause of stress and suffering. It's easy to kind of get hung up on those first two noble truths and just sort of see the darkness, see the suffering. But it goes on, the third and fourth noble truth, that it's possible to cease the stress and suffering. And there's a path. There are technologies, there are practices, there are observances, there are restraints that lead to the end of suffering. And I find hope in this. Anything that you identify that's between you and feeling free in any moment, any complaint, any discomfort, if you investigate it, you will find eventually the cause. Some form of clinging, some form of attachment, some form of identification, and the inability to let it go. Some belief. And we know we can let go because we've done it. You let go a little bit of freedom. Let go a lot of freedom. So how do we let go? This is where compassion comes in. It's the caring. It's the lubrication that helps you to contact that grief, that fear, that pain, that discomfort, that stress, that anxiety, to let it know you see it, to sense how it wants you to be with it, that allows you, that opens the field for it to change. So in this awakening of wisdom and compassion, it becomes a question of what is a fully awakened heart, bodhicitta, the fully awakened heart and mind. It's a profound balance. Compassion by itself has no boundaries. It's limitless. Someone falls and they break their leg, you'll do anything to help them. Wisdom sees the karma of things, cause and effect. You can look strictly through the lens of wisdom and see everything as karma playing out. Someone falls and breaks their leg. Well, maybe they pushed someone over and broke their leg in another lifetime and everything's getting balanced out. The balance of holding compassion and seeing and understanding cause and effect, that's an exquisite place. The best way I can describe that is if you've ever seen a 15-year-old fall deeply in love for the first time, you know their heart is going to be ripped to shreds. But you wouldn't change anything because that's part of being human. It's part of maturing. It's part of being alive. It doesn't take the compassion away, but at the same time, there's an understanding. Here's what Walpola Rahula said. According to Buddhism, for someone to be perfect, there are two qualities that should be developed equally: compassion on one side and wisdom on the other. Here, compassion represents love, charity, kindness, tolerance, and such noble qualities on the emotional side, the qualities of heart. While wisdom would stand for the intellectual side, the qualities of mind. If one develops only the emotional, neglecting the intellectual, one may become a good-hearted fool. While to develop only the intellectual side, neglecting the emotional, may turn one into a hard-hearted intellectual without feeling for others. Therefore, to be perfect, one has to develop both equally. This is the aim of the practice. Wisdom and compassion are inseparably linked together. So this element of compassion is one of what are called the immeasurable states. Compassion, kindness, joy, and equanimity. When you experience, when you are in these states, they truly have no limit. They're cultivated through developing mindfulness, the capacity for non-judging awareness. And they're cultivated by paying attention to these qualities, by recognizing the barriers, the obstacles to those states, of recognizing what's between you and those states and investigating them. when we can bring this into our practice, we can begin to open up to marvelous experiences. We can really sense into what it means to be fully awake and fully alive in the heart and in the mind. So perhaps we can close with a meditation on these states of compassion and the immeasurable states as well. With the eyes closed, you might gently feel the breath. And you might just sense or imagine or feel if you were able to invoke a sense of compassion for yourself. What would that feel like right now? You might reflect on someone close to you, someone to whom your attention, affection, and love flow easily, and just explore what it's like to wish them well. You might reflect on those with whom you are sharing this retreat. Sensing the person to your left and to your right, the person behind, the person in front. To wish them well. There is a wonderful balance, that which we seek is not just found within, but found in this relational field, this shared experience. These lines from Kabir: are you looking for me? I am in the next seat. My shoulder is against yours. You will not find me in stupas, not in Indian shrine rooms, nor in synagogues, nor in cathedrals, not in masses, nor kirtans, not in legs winding around your own neck, nor in eating nothing but vegetables. When you really look for me, you will see me. You will find me in the tiniest house of time. Kabir says, student, tell me, what is God? He is the breath inside the breath. We'll close with an offering of merit, honoring all that you have brought to this day, whatever merit, whatever benefit you have generated through your sincere intentions, offering the merit, the blessings, deeply and intimately to yourself. May your path deepen and widen in ease and well-being. Whatever merit, whatever benefit you may have generated this day in this retreat, you might offer it to those in your inner circle, those to whom your love flows easily and effortlessly. May these beings benefit from the fruit of your practice. You might offer it freely to those around you, those with whom you have been sharing this time of practice. May these beings benefit from the fruit of your practice. And you might imagine this offering like a light in a night sky, shining in all directions to all beings without discrimination. May all beings, those you are yet to meet in your journey personally, those who are suffering, those who are coming into form, those who are falling out of form, all beings this planet, extending out in all directions into the night sky. May all beings benefit from the fruit of your practice. And as you offer it out, offering it deeply and intimately to yourself, to this breath, to each cell of your body. Namaste. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.